First, let me again thank Governor Engler for teeing up the critical issues in today's entire event. I will forever have a different view of Macedonia thanks to that article that he shared with us. But he also articulated the challenge of policy levels of what to do about franchising, when is it interstate commerce versus an issue for the state, on rate regulation and as well as other types of regulation on video franchising. But then went further to say there are roles for the states, which I hope our second panel will bring into the discussion. You know, traditional lines between cable and phone companies has been mentioned as blurred, and I think will be obliterated with internet protocol technology. And depending on your view, the question of franchising has a lot of different perspectives. I'm not going to go into a large summary of it because the panelists, I'll get right to them. I would like to say, we've talked with all the panelists in advance, are going to interject that issue that Governor Engler mentioned of net neutrality and in particular the non-discrimination mandate, which I share his view leads to rate regulation if it's taken seriously, because it has been talked about in legislation up on the Hill. In fact, there are proponents of separate legislation requiring it. There are some key issues that I hope our panel will address. The first would be how do the principles of federalism affect this argument? To what extent should the federal government exercise preemption of franchising authority, or to what extent should we leave that to the states? Should new entrants in the video market be subject to the same build-out requirements that existing incumbents are? What has happened when there is new competition in Texas and Virginia, too early for my home state of Indiana to tell? Are the benefits to consumers that are anticipated in fact occurring, or will that be a temporary effect and we won't see any consumer welfare in the long run? And then finally, that question on what should be done with net neutrality, both in terms of the access issue and I think more fundamentally the mandate on non-discrimination, which in the context of negotiating deals for how much you charge people for services means you regulate the rate if you're going to force people to, quote, not discriminate between two different customers. Today, we have a very distinguished panel with us. I'll briefly introduce them all and then introduce each of them as they get ready to speak, but we've got Professor Tom Hazlett from George Mason University, John Neuer, who's the Acting Assistant Secretary for NTIA, Kyle McSlero, the President and CEO of the National Cable and Telecommunications Association. Kyle's a Federalist. He was co-founder of the UVA's chapter way back when. We won't say how many years. Libby Beatty is the Executive Director of the National Associations of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors, and John McCormick is the President and CEO of the United States. Walter McCormick is the President and CEO of the United States Telecom Association. Let's start with Professor Hazlett. I first encountered his writings back in the 1990s when we were debating whether to regulate the cable industry. And he was an advocate for free markets and the benefits of competition for consumers. He's continued to write prolifically in the area of telecommunications. We owe him an apology from the Federalist Society. He had requested a screen for a couple slides.
Apology. It's okay.
He had an Thanks. Even more elucidating presentation. we'll let him slog through in the verbal format. Tom, thank you.
Thanks very much. I do have a PowerPoint presentation, and it's a truly excellent presentation. I think it's probably one of the best ones you've ever, not seen. So you'll have to take my word for it. And my usual problem is I forget where I put my memory stick, which seems to be a terribly paradoxical problem here in the electronic age. I do have a long law review paper coming out in the Virginia Journal of Law and Technology called Cable TV Franchises as Barriers to Video Competition, and that paper is on my website at the George Mason University Law School if you'd like to access it. I wrote another version of that paper that was published in the July 1986 University of Pennsylvania Law Review. So I've been doing this for a while, and I'm very happy to have issues just recirculate on sort of an oscillating basis here in Washington and in the capitals of government around the country and around the world, so I can amortize my human capital generation after generation. Many of the issues today very similar to the issues 20 years ago. I will say that 20 years ago, the argument for market competition and relaxation of entry barriers in cable was met, if you really got down to it, with the coup de grace question. The coup de grace, the sort of the flesh you out as a person that really didn't belong in the discussion. The coup de grace question was, and so I guess you think there could be competition in the phone business. You see, that was the 1986 end of conversation question. And here we are 20 years later, and we're still talking about competition in cable, and telephone competition is taken for granted, that's already here. Now, there's generally two sets of arguments on the pro side for local cable franchising and maintaining, if not increasing, the entry barriers on second entrance, competitors in the markets, which today are usually telephone companies in local video markets, is regulatory parity. The incumbents had to go through the franchising process, so should the entrants. The con argument against that is that the franchising process itself is an inefficient barrier to entry, evaluated on its own merits, which is the only way to do this in a pro-consumer way, okay, on its own merits in terms of its effect on consumers. The argument is overwhelming that, in my opinion, that the entry barrier is inefficient, the franchising barrier in general, that in fact new rivals, particularly those rivals that already have franchises to use rights of way in a responsible way, should not be constrained in any material way by a cable franchising process. There's no reason for it. It's a duplicative overlay. And in fact, this is exactly the logic of the 1996 Telecommunications Act with respect to telephony. Okay, we actually got in 1996 a national policy that preempted states or localities from imposing franchise barriers on companies that wanted to go into the telephone business. That policy has actually worked pretty well. There have been lots of sideshows and diversions through something called unbundling policy, but in fact now the facilities-based competition policy has finally been unleashed. We've given up on the network sharing stuff. And in fact, right now as we sit here, half of all American homes can get telephone service from a telephone company or a cable TV company. Okay, that's half of all U.S. homes. And those cable television companies did not have to go through a franchising barrier at the local or state level that imposed any significant burdens, no build-out requirements, universal service obligations, obligations of a last resort provider, stuff that the incumbents in that market had to do and, in fact, still maintain obligations to do under various franchise and federal policy requirements. If you actually look at the regulatory parity argument, it falls apart very quickly. Many of the existing cable TV systems did not build their systems out under franchises at all. Prior to 1984 in the Cable Act, there was no requirement that local cable systems had to have franchises. And in fact, many jurisdictions, particularly lots of unincorporated county areas, had the opportunity to build a cable system with a business license. That was it. There was no cable television franchise. That requirement was imposed in the 1984 Cable Act, something that the cable industry strongly supported for obvious reasons, I think. Now, the fact is that there was no problem with allowing entrance into the market without a franchise at all. There have always been local government jurisdiction over certain rights of way to stop a so-called externality problem. That is to say, there could be some nuisance created for the citizens or residents of the community. That should be regulated, or the cost should be imposed not on the citizens but on the creator of the disturbance, and internalized. Use of rights of way is regulated. Certainly there are franchise fees that charge for that, and those policies can be instituted by national or state policies that do not, in fact, require franchises. The fact is that there are lots of asymmetries. When people talk about regulatory parity, they're talking about something that is nominally, in some cases nominally equal, usually not, but in some cases nominally equal, but highly asymmetric in terms of the economic impact. And the easiest way to see that is just to talk about the build-out requirement. If you're the first entrant into a market, you rightfully have anticipated in cable television that you will be the lone provider of wireline video. And in that market, with 100% market share of wireline video and prices that are 15 to 20% higher than in a head-to-head competitive market, you can take on certain obligations. Now, the obligations have never been universal service. They've been general build-out requirements that have said that cable operators have to build down to about 30 homes per mile, meaning the very sparsely populated parts of a market, they typically don't have an obligation to serve. That's different than the telephony business by and large. But that's the way cable's developed. Now, it turns out if you just run the numbers under the assumptions for what a second entrant might be able to produce in terms of revenues, the actual burden, economic burden, really kicks in much on those kinds of requirements, kicks in at a much higher level. So it might be break-even for a monopoly cable provider to actually build out to a part of the market that's 20 or 25 homes per mile, and a second entrant might not find it profitable to the 50 or 60 homes per mile. And so just the asymmetry of the burden, even though the words may be nominally the same, is apparent. Now, in reality, the actual build-out requirements have been enforced in the breach by and large. That is to say, if you actually look at the data on how build-out has occurred in the cable television industry, there are very few systems that built out in 1, 2, or 3 years as per franchise requirements. And many, of course, cable franchises have taken 5, 10, 15 years or longer to actually build out to coverage, and even coverages that were quote-unquote mandated in franchise agreements. And this is just sort of the loose regulation that's been provided. So in terms of the regulatory symmetry, you run into a problem. The fact is that we can get build-out for competitive video services. In fact, that will will spur build-out of high-speed internet broadband services because of the very large complementarities. Obviously, phone companies coming into video want to build integrated hybrid systems that provide phone, voice, data, high speed, and video. And to cut out the video portion of this, you read any of the analyst reports, this just kills the business model. This is another reason why it's such a battleground today between cable and phone operators. There are 33,000 local franchise authorities in the United States, according to the FCC. And it takes some significant investment, by and large, in each of those areas, each of those franchises, to actually get the franchise. And this delays entry. Every year you delay entry, you've sacrificed the benefits of competition. Those have been estimated in many, many survey studies by the GAO, the FCC, economists. Have looked at this in many occasions. The benefits per household are about $100 per year in lower prices. And so you can just do the math. If you actually got nationwide head-to-head competition, consumers would save about $9 billion per year. So every year that you actually delay entry, head-to-head entry into the markets for, and this is just the video market, not talking about the complementary goods that will be produced in larger quantities and sooner, like high-speed broadband. The fact is that you get very significant consumer benefits gained by going faster and lost by going slower. The franchise, which is there to regulate and in fact duplicate the regulation that's provided by other rules and institutions already in place, including telephone franchises, which regulate public use of public rights of way, that duplicative regulation, in fact, should be swept away so that we can speed competition of the market and provide these benefits to American consumers.
Thank you very much, Tom. Our second speaker will be Libby Beatty, who I mentioned is the executive director of NATOA. She also, prior to that, has worked in several areas at the Federal Communications Commission, is an expert on many of these issues, and we welcome her here to the Federalist Society today. Thank you, Libby.
Thank you, David, very much. I appreciate the opportunity to be here this morning. I also wanted to thank Dean Reuter and David Ray on staff here with the Federalist Society for offering the invitation to speak this morning. I should explain for those who are not familiar that the National Association of Telecommunications Officers and Advisors is not an association that represents the telephone industry or the telecommunications industry. Despite the name of the association, we do in fact represent local governments and those franchisors who are not very popular here this morning, as I have has been made quite clear. Nevertheless, I don't believe that franchising is unnecessary. I don't believe that it is, as far as we're concerned at the local level, duplicative of state-level franchising. They serve different purposes for different reasons for quite some time. What we perceive this is all about is competition, and we're very concerned that our communities, our citizens, and our opportunities are as broad as the telecommunications industry is promoting. We want to make sure that as many as can be served as possible. And the build-out requirements that Governor Engler was inquired of earlier actually are current federal law. So when local governments obligate our friends at Verizon to build out a community, quite often as not today, it is as a matter of current federal law under Title VI that we do so. And we do so to be competitively neutral with the competitor that is already in the right-of-way delivering video services. So while we can discuss the benefits of changing the federal law, there are still some, we believe, societal reasons to protect against things like discrimination and what has become a very popular term, redlining and cherry-picking. There are reasons to protect against that. We'd like all of our consumers to enjoy competition, not just the 10% that are currently on the game plan out there for today. It's about property rights. It's about both the individual property rights of consumers and the property owned by local governments themselves as property owners and held in trust for the public they serve. No one should have to call Washington, D.C. to resolve a problem with a provider in their community. We don't think that that's the best solution, and we don't think that a federal solution that obligates a consumer to do so is the appropriate course of action. It's about contracts. It's about abrogating contracts. And when do we stop? At what point? We agree that the time is ripe for change, and certainly no one in local government today is trying to forestall competition. We all need it for our economic development purposes. We all need it for our education purposes. The governor indicated that Madagascar or someplace?
Macedonia,
thank you. They're serving all the schools. Well, much to the credit of the cable industry has been obligated under franchising to serve many schools and libraries for many, many years. It's one of those obligations that comes under the franchise that has served our communities and served them well. We'd like to continue to educate our children using these technological resources. We'd like to continue to ensure that they have access to the best technology available. And we've done so based on those agreements, those contracts, which were negotiated consistent with and under the terms of federal law. Someone spoke about certainty. Well, governments need certainty too. and if we can't rely on the contracts that we negotiated consistent with the instructions we took from our federal government and our state governments, then we are in a terrible situation. We would like to see there be some transition if we are going to move to the brave new world. Let's do so in a much more cautious fashion. The 1996 Act was a deregulatory act that was intended to enhance and encourage competition. We have seen some competition. Some communities have competition, but we've seen a significantly higher rate of consolidation. While the industry may complain about having to go to all of these different local governments, franchising, when it originated as a result of the property right, the grant to use the rights of way in the community. And more often than not, these were local businesses. These were not mega conglomerates doing business out of a single city in a single state and serving millions of customers across the nation. These were mom-and-pop operations in our communities that we were cutting deals with and making contracts with and relying on. And as the consolidation has increased across this nation in these particular venues, now we find ourselves doing business with Philadelphia or Atlanta or Washington or San Antonio in a way that's been unprecedented. Local governments are there to protect and serve you. They are accountable to you. There is no one more accountable than the local community's elected officials, the state elected officials, and then finally the federally elected officials. But when it comes down to brass tacks, if you want to make a complaint as a consumer, you're going to be heard at your local level much faster than you are at the state level or the federal level. And from my perspective, from my association's perspective, it's about serving the consumer, making sure that they are given the same competitive opportunities in a fair and efficient fashion, that their property rights are protected, that their interests are protected, that their community is served, and that we are able to do this and still offer the best technology across this country possible. So, thank you for letting me speak this morning. I appreciate it.
Libby, it's wonderful to have you. Thank you for coming. And your defense of federalism is very, always welcome at the Federalist Society, even if on a particular issue we may not agree. Our next speaker is a dear friend, Kyle McSlarrow, president and CEO of the National Cable and Telecom Communications Association. Kyle and I, in addition to having in common starting Federalist Society chapters, both had the privilege at various points in our lives of working with Dan Quayle and also working after the contract with America on trying to change things up on the Hill. So Kyle is somebody we're very glad to have with us today, representing the cable industry in their perspective.
David, thank you, and thanks for outing me on being part of the Federalist Society conspiracy.
It's about time.
I'm probably the least knowledgeable about telecom in terms of the panel here because I've been in this job just a little over a year. But I was struck when I came into this job, actually horrified by the level of micromanagement and the regulatory superstructure that pervades all of telecom. I was really just stunned by it. And the cable industry's view has been that, number one, it's completely appropriate and timely for us to take a fresh look at the telecom landscape. Obviously, the architecture largely enacted by the 96 Act most recently. We think we ought to be stripping away completely or at least minimizing to the extent possible all economic regulation on us and all of our competitors across all of these services. I agree with the point that's been made several times earlier that it's an overused term, but it's the best one I guess we have, that with convergence we just need to think differently about what's happening in that landscape. I can tell you that the companies I represent, even though we keep talking about cable TV, they don't even think of themselves as cable TV. they think of themselves as broadband providers, and they offer several services, and they offer video, and they offer data, high-speed internet access, and increasingly they offer digital phone. So I think all of us probably have a commonality in terms of we need to think about this space, you know, in a different way and act accordingly. We've also learned some things from 96. The cable industry, as Professor Hazlett intimated, is in some ways the poster child of the success of deregulation. I mean, Congress deregulated us in 96 over a three-year period, not completely because we're looking for more, but in a substantial way, and we proceeded to go out and invest $100 billion to put fiber into the ground and build a two-way interactive network over the next 10 years. And that's the kind of policy success that ought to engender repetition across the board, and it's a lesson. So what I try to distinguish is what is the policy that we're grappling with, that the members of Congress are grappling with right now, that ought to govern for the next two decades, not what's the food fight over the next 2 years, because that's kind of what it's turned into. And it's telescoped initially, and of course this panel's largely focused on it, into this issue of video franchising. And one of the problems I have is actually with the term franchise, because you use that word, and probably for most people in this room, you know, almost immediately there's a connotation of, you know, something from the guilds in the Middle Ages, and there's a connotation of exclusivity. And almost all of those things don't actually reflect the reality of what takes place in franchising in America today. I think you can make an intellectually coherent argument for lots of different regimes in the telecom space. But I also do think, as Professor Hazlett mentioned, we have to take a look at the facts. One assertion that has been made has been that franchises are a barrier to entry. Now, theoretically and academically, I'm not going to quibble with what Professor Hazlett has written, and I've tried to read most of what he has written and said on the subject, because I think he comes at this in a very thoughtful way. But in fact, looking at what's happening out there right now with Verizon and AT&T, who are largely the people making this argument, AT&T isn't even trying to get franchises because they argue they're not even a cable service under the federal statute. Verizon, in every instance where they've gotten, I think, about 50 franchises right now, in almost every instance, the average time after they received the franchise is about 4 months before they're even ready to deliver the video service. So by definition, the franchising process didn't stop them from doing anything because they weren't even ready to deliver the service. Now, that doesn't answer the question of what the right policy is, but I do think we have to clear away some of the brush about whether or not the franchising process, just as a matter of you know, a factual basis, is doing something to stop new entrants from entering the market. That is clearly false. In terms of going forward, I mean, one of the arguments that we have made has been, even though we sort of telescoped on video franchising, that we ought to broaden the discussion and think about the full competitive marketplace between us and our competitors. Now, principally, people think about this in terms of the Bells and cable, but there are obviously other providers, wireless providers, and what have you. Our argument has been there ought to be parity, ideally parity down in a more deregulatory fashion. You know, for example, last year, many of you may be familiar with the Brand X Supreme Court decision, upheld the FCC's ruling that that our high-speed internet access service should be treated with a light regulatory touch. The term of art is as an information service under the existing telecommunications law. And the telephone companies went to the FCC and said, we think DSL should be treated the same way. And we agreed with that, and we supported that, because it was clearly the right answer. You ought to treat like services alike. I think the hard question in this space, and it's not just a video question, is if you accept the premise that I've asserted that we ought to strip away all the economic regulation, you're still left with some pretty difficult issues of, okay, what's the social policy that ought to apply in each of those services? And there are clearly some, and on a bipartisan basis, and whether you're not, you're somebody who's a free market philosopher, you're going to think some should apply. So, for example, when it comes to phone, even if someone argues that we ought to get rid of all economic regulation, most people would still concede it's appropriate to have some type of regulatory obligation to provide E911 or to comply with CALEA, the law enforcement statute. Some would even go further and say that you should have an obligation to pay into the Universal Service Fund. Same thing with high-speed data. There are some social obligations that come with that that most people agree ought to apply to that service. And then when you get to video, I think what we discover is fundamentally what the debate has been about and what's already been talked about here has been what are the responsibilities that flow in a local community to service to the residents of that community. And just by virtue of saying, let's get away from economic regulation, I don't think you can avoid some of those more difficult issues. And, you know, we have argued that one difficulty in this debate has been that if you take the local communities out of the process, you've taken away the one actor that, in essence, as Libby said, acts as a proxy for some of those issues. If you take them out of the equation and just say, you file a piece of paper, you provide service, if you care about any of those other social policies, you actually have to end up potentially with a more prescriptive regulatory structure to answer the social policy questions. What's happening right now is, in law, there is no actual provision that says a cable company or a telephone company or anybody offering video service has to build out X number of years to X number of houses per mile. In essence, what's happened is it's a bargaining between the city or the county or whoever and that provider. If you take them out of it, and if people think that there's still an important social policy, and everybody, so far as I can tell, including the telephone companies, have said publicly they agree there should be a non-discrimination on the basis of income requirement, you still have to answer the question, okay, and how is that implemented? That is, I think, where the debate has come at this point. Bottom line for our industry is whatever path Congress chooses, what we're going to insist on and what I think we've obviously seen happen in the House and to some extent in the Senate bill that's been introduced is that there ought to be a level playing field. Ideally, a level playing field down, but at the bottom, a level playing field. These are all fairly well-resourced companies. This is, you know, 2006. It's time to get on with it and stop fighting in the regulatory marketplace and go out and compete in the competitive marketplace. And I'll stop there and just and not say anything on net neutrality. I'll assume that comes up a little later.
Okay, great. Thank you, Kyle. And some of the things you've mentioned, I think I hope people will stay for the second panel. As Governor Engler mentioned, issues like consumer protection. Is that something that the state should look at, to have a role in? Our next speaker is also a friend from time served together in the first Bush administration. Walter was in the general counsel at the Transportation Department, went on to head up the National Trucking Association, and now is president and CEO of U.S. Telecom. We can thank Walter for the sort of imaginative ads that point out the changes that have occurred in technology as you walk through the airport and other places in our lives. Walter, thank you very much for joining us.
David, thank you. Thank you very much. And I'd like to begin just by telling you something you already know. On Sunday evening, a local broadcaster here, Channel 7, broadcast a very popular TV show, Desperate Housewives. The next morning, if you opened up the newspaper, you saw a full-page ad from ABC saying that if you missed Desperate Housewives, you could simply log on to the ABC website and watch Desperate Housewives anytime you wanted on Monday. Or you could watch Lost, or you could watch any of the other ABC programs. Now, was that a cable service or a broadcast service? Or if you were accessing it by wireless, was it a wireless service? Or did the consumer really care? We only care because those are government definitions. Similarly, if you want to listen to local talk radio WTOP, you can do it over your car radio. Or if you happen to be in Los Angeles, you can log on to the WTOP website And if you have a cell phone in Los Angeles, you can call into the talk show. And is that a local call or a long-distance call? And when WTOP broadcasts your conversation, is that a local broadcast or is that a national broadcast? Is that a local channel or a Clear channel? These definitions no longer make sense in a world where technology is developing so rapidly. I represent a trade association that's 110 years old. Our companies began by offering voice service, telephone service, a term that will quickly become archaic. But once we added high-speed internet access, it became easy to offer video. Similarly, the cable industry began by offering video. But once it offered high-speed internet access, it became easy to offer voice. And so the cable industry deployed voice, not pursuant to a build-out requirement, not pursuant to having to go get a franchise. They offered cable modem service, not pursuant to a build-out requirement or a requirement to offer a franchise. And who has benefited from this? Well, it's the consumer who has benefited. Just last month, everybody wanted to watch the NCAA Final Four games. Now, you could do that over cable, or you could do that by going into DirecTV or Dish TV, neither of which offer video pursuant to a local franchise. Or once again, you could do it by logging on to the NCAA website and by buying a package from the NCAA. So where we are with the franchise requirement is we are engaged in a debate, not about whether there should be no role for government, because I think we all believe that there should be some role for government, but the issue is what is the appropriate role for government, particularly with regard to services that are inherently interstate. And should the role of government be to slow innovation, slow deployment, stop the world until we have a chance to figure out what regulatory silo those go into? Or should the role of government be more limited? Now, we've gone through this debate before. When the interstate highway system was developed, Congress said, if you can choose between a truck and a train, government's going to get out of the way and let the consumer choose. We believe that today, where you can freely choose to get high-speed internet access from cable modem or DSL, from wireless, from Wi-Fi, from WiMAX, from satellite, government has stepped back. Let the consumer choose. We feel the same with regard to video. We want to upgrade our telephone facility to offer an application that technology has made it capable of being able to offer, preserving an appropriate role for government. In the transportation context, while we said that customers should be free to choose between a truck and a train for their transportation needs, we did say that they had to continue to operate safely. So there continues to be a Department of Transportation that regulates safety. It doesn't regulate pricing options or pricing packages, but it does say that the trains and trucks and airlines and pipelines will operate safely. And similarly, with regard to telecommunications, we believe that if someone holds themselves as a provider of a voice service, that they should have a responsibility to offer 911. If somebody calls 911 in the middle of the night, they want to know that that call is going to go through. That is an obligation about just operating safely. We think that there is a role in an age where we're fighting terrorism, where law enforcement continues to need to deal with child abductions, there should be a role for wiretapping. And we have said that with regard to localities, even as we move into the video space, that we should make sure that localities are made whole with regard to the franchise fees that they're receiving, the fees that they receive for iNet and PEG channels, and that we should, you know, make available to localities PEG channels. Although, frankly, in an internet environment, you could set up your own website and offer as many channels as you wanted. But we've said that, you know, even though we think that the technology is somewhat archaic of sort of dedicated governmental channels, that that's been an area where we don't want to upset the apple cart. But beyond that, we think that the free market is what has made America unique. We think that the free market in the 19th century and 20th century, where other societies were saying we need to have government-managed competition, we need to have central state planning by regulators, we said, no, we're not going to do that. And the free market has led to the highest standard of living, the greatest social progress, the greatest innovation that the world has ever known. And we think that now that internet technology has taken us to the place where people can access the internet by a variety of ways, that those who deploy networks should be free to offer over those networks whatever services technology makes possible for them to offer. And it is an exciting, exciting time for consumers because innovation and technological advancement is leading to greater creativity than we've ever seen in the telecom space. So that's where we come from, David. Thank you for having me. Appreciate being here.
Thank you, Walter. Thank you very, very much. Our final speaker on this panel is a representative of the Bush administration. John is the acting assistant secretary of NTIA, as I mentioned, has responsibility for regulating the government-owned spectrum as well as setting out policy for the United States on telecom issues. He has had extensive experience in that as deputy before becoming acting secretary, assistant secretary, and appreciate you taking time with us, John. And John shared with me he preferred to react to the other panelists, and so we'll let you begin the reaction and then open it up for a discussion back and forth.
Well, thanks very much. You know, with all the ads that have been in the trades and in the airport, getting this seat next to Kyle and Walter kind of feels like ringside Ali Frazier. I mean, so far the early rounds aren't quite living up to billing, but maybe you guys will heat up a little bit as we get on to questions. Anyhow, I thought I would just sort of put in context what the administration thinks about the importance of creating an environment where we can have really dynamic competition in this space. This is often cast as competition in the video marketplace, or this is the cable versus the incumbent phone companies. The critical thing to remember and to appreciate is that we need to be promoting an environment where we have competition in not just the incumbent services, but in the developing converged services, all of the applications and services that can be provided here. This, to my mind, really is the comparative advantage of our economy, and that's what this is important for. This brings increased productivity, increased standards of living. We get lots of criticism for our standing in broadband deployment and broadband access and broadband uptake in this world. Frankly, I think based on the competitive environment that we've had emerging, like Kyle mentioned, the $100 billion that's been invested in his industry, Walter's industry likely has hundreds of billions of dollars in invested capital and are putting in additional tens of billions as we speak. This is our advantage in the developing economy and in the global economy. If we continue to have a competitive marketplace in ICT technologies writ large, not just for video services, I think Walter's examples are very helpful in telling that it's becoming impossible to identify what the regulatory classifications of these services are because the technology has gotten completely agnostic as to the delivery of these services and the reception of these services by consumers. By having a competitive marketplace, we will continue to have the most innovative marketplace in the world. We will be attract capital, we will attract human capital, and we will continue to have the kind of economy that allows us to lead the world in all the sorts of metrics that Walter was talking about. I think, you know, that is the framework we need to keep in mind as we have this debate, as Congress thinks about this, as we talk about this for the rest of the morning. But I think it's I'm very interested and grateful to have had the opportunity to listen to the rest of the panelists and happy to engage in the rest of the debate.
Terrific. Thank you very much, John. Thank you for everybody on the panel. I'm going to throw out my net neutrality question and get folks' reaction on that. What do they see as the issues there? What views should Congress do or at the state level? And anybody who wants to jump in?
We're both ready to go on that.
Go ahead, Tom.
I mean, in some ways, I mean, we're obviously have been focused on the video franchising, but in some ways, that is such a small issue by comparison to the potential consequences of net neutrality if we get this wrong. Fundamentally, the what's at stake with the net neutrality debate, I believe, is most significantly, the effect it has on innovation and investment in this country, innovation and investment in broadband networks themselves, but also for applications providers. And you know, there, you know, good people can disagree on this debate. Fundamentally, I think the divide is between those who believe there is not a competitive marketplace for high-speed internet access service today and not likely to be anytime in the near future, which I just fundamentally disagree with. I'm sure Walter would say the same for his guys. I know my guys get up every morning. They think they are in a robust, bitter, competitive fight with the telephone companies over selling high-speed internet access. We've got wireless broadband coming along. We've got Muni Wi-Fi coming along. We've got broadband over power lines around the corner. We've got satellite delivery, and who knows what else over the next 10 years. And if you subscribe to the view that it's a competitive marketplace, I think logic takes you to the next conclusion, which is that it's in our interest to give our consumers the best possible experience they can have. And that means the fastest speeds, the greatest ability to navigate on the web and to do things in and around the internet and to use those services from the applications providers that they're going to want without discrimination. That is the marketplace working. If you don't subscribe to the view that the broadband providers are in a competitive marketplace, I guess logic takes you to the next conclusion, which is that you have to, quote-unquote, do something. So fundamentally, I think the premise is wrong. But even if you accept that there's a do-something component to this, I just don't know how you do it. And every attempt I've seen, once you see language, which actually lays this out, shows the confusion about this debate. One set of people think net neutrality is an issue about whether or not telephone companies or cable providers or other broadband providers are going to limit in some way a consumer's ability to access a particular website. Well, we've all said, not going to do it, haven't done it, where's the proof? And so most of those people have then said, okay, well, we accept that, nothing's actually going wrong. So now we've morphed into a much more sophisticated and I think a much more dangerous debate, which is over management of the network itself, which is a fairly sophisticated operation. I mean, we all just sort of click on and we think all this stuff works. What's behind that is incredibly complex, particularly as you have hugely intensive bandwidth applications that are running over not the public internet and then obviously any of the private networks as well. And a lot goes into that, and when you actually start to play out, when you look at the language that's floating around out there and you start to play out, what you really get down to is fundamentally a philosophy that networks, and we've seen this in many arenas, not just the telecom arena, but that networks should just be common carriers. They should be dumb pipes, they should provide a service, they should provide the highway, and then they should get out of the way because all the smart people on the edge are going to figure out the cool applications. Well, the truth is there's robust competition among broadband providers and among applications providers, and there's competition between broadband providers and applications providers, and the consumer is benefiting today. It's interesting to me, Walter and I testified before the Senate Commerce Committee, and I said that day, I had gone back and looked, and roughly 4 years before we testified that day, the Senate Commerce Committee had a hearing on net neutrality, and representatives of Google think maybe the same person who was testifying that day had said, if you don't do something on net neutrality, the internet as we know it will end. And 4 years later, Google has $100 billion+ market cap. So I'm not exactly certain what the problem is, but I'm certain that the government getting into this business is rife with all kinds of danger.
Can I take just a moment
and sure.
sort of echo what Kyle said? For many of you, you're probably wondering exactly what is the problem? What is the problem that Congress is considering trying to fix? And the real debate here is what's the appropriate role for government? There is no problem today. I said a few moments ago, if you wanted to watch Desperate Housewives on the internet, you can point and click and you can do it. You know, if you want to sign up for Starz movie service on the internet, you can do that today. And you can download as many movies as you want. Or you can watch them in real time on the internet. Today, the customer is in control of his or her internet experience. The telephone and cable companies block, impair, degrade, prioritize information in the future. What if they do that? We want to make sure that their networks are managed in a way that is completely dumb, is completely plain vanilla, that everybody's information runs exactly the same over those networks. Well, first of all, we don't know exactly how to do that because today information is prioritized. For example, we have virtual private networks that the federal government has. Those are secure. Those are private. We have networks that we operate for healthcare institutions and financial institutions that offer privacy and security. And so there are already worked into our networks certain 911 services, for example, are prioritized services. So we're not exactly how to operate the network plain vanilla. But more importantly, this is a debate about how new business models shall develop. So Google today has a 60% market share of the internet search market. Double the market share of the search market that we have with regard to the internet access market. Google wants to be able to offer new services in the future. Entertainment packages that might compete with the cable industry's offering of cable service or our offering of video services. And Google doesn't want to build networks for that. What it wants to do is to make absolutely sure that, and again, we're not sure exactly how this would operate, that theirs can run alongside and parallel on our networks and that all of the investment be capitalized by a flat charge to the end consumer, rather than any kind of negotiation with the providers of these advanced services about building out the networks to their specifications. So, for example, we work today with Bank of America to build out a network. We don't raise the cost on everybody getting DSL. We work with Bank of America. Google doesn't want to have to do that. Google wants to be able to, say, raise the cost on everybody, so they have suggested that if everybody were just charged about $50 a month for internet access, everybody would be able to have the same offering. The argument of those who were pushing net neutrality is a scarcity argument. In order to buy their argument, you have to accept their premise that consumers only have the choice of cable, modem, and DSL. This is clearly not the case. I see somebody on the internet right here with a laptop computer that's operating wirelessly. I actually went to a demonstration where Starz showed in a hotel accessing an EVDO network, you know, their ability to download movies, and you could do it in an airport. So there's cable access to the internet, there's wireline access to the internet, there's wireless access to the internet, there's satellite access to the internet. You've seen Dish TV and DirecTV advertising. There's Wi-Fi and WiMAX access in many communities. The only barrier to entry there is the willingness to invest. There is, in some communities, beginning to develop access over power line. And there are also some private spectrum arrangements like out in Middleburg where people are deploying high-speed internet access. So you have a market for high-speed internet access that's very, very competitive. And in a competitive market, we believe the government should stay out of the way. We don't believe that government should get into managing competition on the internet. We believe that government should do what it's done so far. No problems have developed that warrant congressional attention today. Let's step back and not legislate what-ifs.
David, can I just make a...
Yes, Tom.
Just add a little bit here from a different perspective. The argument for net neutrality, as we've just heard, is we have to save the internet. It's been made recently. It's been made 4 years ago by Google. It was made almost a decade ago by AOL before they became an incumbent service provider. But and that was the open access debate, which I invite you all to take a look at. The cable modem regulation issue was lost by the regulation advocates. It's a good thing it was lost. Broadband penetration and broadband competition has benefited enormously from the deregulation of cable modems, and in fact now the deregulation of DSL in competition with that. I've got a paper on that, in matter of fact. I'd be happy to share with you if you'd like that. But the absolute fact of the matter is the market competition, stimulating that competition, is the right answer to this. And it's not something, it's a square peg round hole problem right here. And what I mean by that is there's lots of discrimination. The argument is there cannot be any discrimination by the internet service providers. That will ruin the internet as we know it. Okay. Well, the internet as we know it actually is unregulated. Okay. So it's just a contradiction in terms to say let's regulate it to keep it as we know it. Well, it's not regulated, so that would change how we know it. That's the fundamental cut here. And let's just take a quick peek at how this discrimination takes place. Look at the internet backbone. Now, I'm not going to go through a technical discussion of this, but the fact is that the big traffic leaps on the internet are handled by private investors and capital who create these high-speed, high-capacity, long-distance lines, and that stuff is completely unregulated. In fact, there are no interconnection obligations in the internet backbone. Okay, there's no common carrier rules, and in fact, there's lots of discriminatory pricings. If you're one of the big peers, you get to trade traffic with other big peers at a zero cost. It's called bill and keep. You just send traffic back and forth. It roughly cancels out. If you're a smaller internet service provider, you have to pay. You pay more. Than if you were bigger. It's an incentive to get bigger and provide better service. It actually works very nicely. We can see that it works very nicely. It's an unregulated market, and it's now what other people say is so great we have to protect it because it's open end-to-end. It's not open end-to-end. It's regulated by contract, by privately agreed contracts by all these private property rights holders. Now, there's a service provided by cable television companies now called digital phone service. And essentially all the big cable operators offer this service, and it gives you priority access to cable infrastructure capacity so that you don't have to share the local area network with other cable modem users, and you get high priority in terms of the long-distance links as well. And other, like Vonage and other voice over internet providers do that, but this service is discriminatory. They will charge you a little bit of a premium to use that service, and it's higher quality service, and it's exactly the sort of application we want provided by internet service providers like the cable operators. It's exactly what we want to stimulate competition with the phone companies and local telephone service. Okay, it's an enormous success to have the market figure out these kinds of solutions and different pricing structures. Different than the buffet, all you can eat, $40, $30 a month for internet access of 1 megabyte per second or whatever the service might be today. So I just finally point out that there's this raging controversy about cable pricing for a big bundle of services where they give you all you can eat. The argument being that there should be a la carte pricing. That's a bad argument. It's an anti-consumer regulation if that goes through. But the flip side of this now is being imposed or the threatened on cable modem service. Now cable modem service has to be all-you-can-eat pricing. It can't have any kind of products broken out. I mean, this is just, you know, throwing darts at the wall and taking a system that works and is extremely complicated in the way it works and it jumps to new efficiencies every day, and just sticking your finger in the middle of it and having this stuff squirt in the wrong direction. And it's absolutely true that the advocates of net neutrality don't know what the rules are. Vince Cerf, the Google advocate on this, will say it candidly, he doesn't know what the rule is. I just heard him give this talk. And it's very hard to come up with a regulatory rule because it will be one size fits all, and it will jump on and impose mandates on thousands, potentially millions of transactions that could be worked out in markets but now can't be worked out with full flexibility because you have regulators essentially imposing pricing structures made in Washington. It is a disaster, and I certainly respect the cable and phone people both being very concerned about it.
Let me ask Libby or John, do you have anything you want to say on net neutrality? John, I know you don't have an administration position yet.
Well, I would just say that Kyle's opening remarks that the overarching objective of this entire deregulatory effort is to pare back to the extent possible economic regulation in this space, and I think that we need to be mindful and careful that on the one hand we're doing that, in the other sphere we're introducing or legislating new authority to open up an entirely new sphere of economic regulation. I think one of the strengths of our economy has been we have very well understood institutions that are very well equipped in dealing with market actors that have market power and abuse that power. So whether it is the FCC or the FTC or the Department of Justice, we have institutions that can deal with the fear that seems to be articulated, that there's going to be an actor with market power that uses that market power to discriminate in favor of affiliated content and services and applications. I think before we introduce an entirely new regulatory legislative framework, we should test that. I think the Commission's principles are a good start. They lay out some sector-specific things that may help guide our other existing institutions. I've got lots of faith that Chairman Martin will engage this in a thoughtful way should there be evidence of problems and concerns. So at the top level, as we taking the entire effort of a piece and not just limiting it to the net neutrality side of things, the effort that we're undergoing is to deregulate this market, this competitive market, create the competitive environment to the extent possible, greatest extent possible. We should be mindful that we don't take away with one hand that we're granting with the other.
Because my members work for locally elected officials, and because those officials have not taken positions on this matter, they are watching it. They have obviously the same concerns as many that have been expressed, but have not adopted policy on it. We have not, as of yet, spoken on it.
Thank you. Mm-hmm. I want to now turn to opening it up to questions, but I would mention, just as a little vignette, I was at our partners meeting, and Mayor Brown's now international with a lot of European offices, talking to the German and the French partners. They both expressed that they thought their governments would be very interested in seeing us have net neutrality, mm-hmm. because they've argued for a long time that there ought to be international regulation of the Internet, and the United States has been a barrier to that, and that perhaps if we pass net neutrality, they could reopen that question. So this debate will go far beyond our borders in its impact. Let me now open it up to any questions that the audience has for any of the panelists. I see someone way in the back. If you could introduce yourself and then ask the question.
I kind of see that
one and the same, that a build-out requirement is a heightened regulatory touch. If you look at the financial pages each day, you will see that Wall Street does not reward the telephone companies and the cable companies for investing in network infrastructure. And part of the reason for that is that Wall Street says, why are you doing this when you can't, if your business goal is to deliver content, you can do it, you know, in a variety of ways. These other companies are doing it in a variety of ways. So why in the world would you be going about it in a way that requires you to risk capital, huge amounts of capital, simply to enter a business that you could enter without going through any kind of franchise process or anything else? History has shown that the free market leads to the greatest investment, the greatest innovation, the greatest social progress. We're going to be investing more when we can demonstrate that we have a business plan that makes a lot of sense, and people are then in return investing in us. And so where you want more deployment, it's really based upon our getting the kind of capital that's necessary to make those investments. We have deployed DSL with great rapidity, you know, faster than any other technology that's ever been deployed. And we have every intention of moving forward to compete on, you know, a broad basis in this space. The biggest incentive for telephone companies to build out is this. We know that if we can't offer our customers a bundle of voice, video, and high-speed internet access, if we're going to just offer them one piece of that, we're going to lose that customer. If we lose that customer, we still have to maintain the infrastructure because we have a legal obligation as carriers of last resort to keep that infrastructure in place whether we have any customers on it or not. So we have a huge incentive to build out. And our view would be, you know, remove governmental barriers and let the marketplace allow us to go out and experiment and begin to deploy and see if we can offer business plans that are going to be making us more competitive with the existing video operators that are out there in the cable and satellite industries.
Yeah, if I had my PowerPoint, I could show you a slide. So you'll have to imagine this. But there are two markets you should compare here: the broadband market and the video or cable market. In broadband, existing operators have been allowed to provide service in their local areas without an additional franchise. Okay, so cable operators who have a video franchise can do broadband and not be regulated. No build-out requirements. Same essentially for there are more requirements, but there's much less regulation than on other stuff in the DSL space. But you can think about this as a cable issue. Well over 90% of U.S. homes can now subscribe to a broadband service. This is in 9 years. In 1997, the number was essentially zero. Okay. Now that's much faster than video build-out came in the United States when you had cable franchising. See, the thing about cable franchise, you can talk about level playing field, which is an old way of saying we want entry barriers for the new guy that look nominally symmetric but are highly economically asymmetric. I wrote an article a few years ago called The Fallacy of Regulatory Symmetry, and happy to share that with you as well. But you can actually look at markets where cable competitors, phone companies, or others have been denied entry, and they would be serving and competing today. And I'll give you the city of Philadelphia. It's my favorite example. In 1998, RCN, a competitor that provided phone service and video service, showed up to the city of Philadelphia, wanted a cable franchise. After 2.5 years of all sorts of demands, build-out requirements essentially, and things of that nature, subsidies, cross-subsidies, these special deals that the cities demand in some cases, the $240 million investment that RCN wanted to make in head-to-head competitive facilities was just shot into space, and RCN walked out in 2001, said we can't, read their annual report, said we can't do this, the city's demanding too much, okay? The city of Philadelphia actually, the mayor, then Mayor Rendell, now governor, took credit for this, said we don't want some fly-by-night company coming in here and competing with our cable, you know, a homegrown cable company, Comcast, having its headquarters in Philadelphia. So now, if you're living in the suburban part of Philadelphia, you can get head-to-head cable service in a lot of those markets. You can't, if you're one of the urban consumers in Philadelphia, get head-to-head competition. You don't have any choice for video service there. Okay, and a big broadband competitor has been kept out of the market. So there are actual households you can point out and say they don't have cable service from a competitor because of the franchising process. And you can do that around the country. That's happened in many places. But the build-out requirements you're talking about are absolutely barriers to entry. That's why the incumbents want to impose them on their entrants. And just ask yourself the simple question: why would an incumbent want a rule that says that the new competitor has to serve the entire market? Can't serve part of it, has to serve the entire market. Why would the incumbent say, we don't mind competition, we just want competition everywhere? Everywhere they get competition, they lose market share. They have to lower their prices. There is a plausible explanation, of course, and you know what it is. They, the incumbent, know that it lowers the probability of any entry to have the franchise barrier in place with the build-out requirement. So build-out requirements are the essential franchise barrier.
If I may respond to that, just on a couple of notes, and Kyle, I may ask your help because I've not been involved in franchising per se for all that long, and you may have some additional information on this, but up until 2002, cable modem service was treated as a cable service, both by local governments, the cable industry, and the federal government. It was not until March 14, 2002, when the FCC made the determination that they perceived cable modem service to be an information service, that everything kind of stopped and the industry and local government started looking at this differently. But in terms of the build-out of the cable infrastructure, if you will, it wasn't so much that local governments were obligating cable companies to build cable modem service out to their communities. Rather, it was under the terms of the franchise that as a cable operator upgraded its facility, it had to upgrade all of its facility over a course of time in a non-discriminatory fashion, consistent with its existing build requirements, so that no community at the end of the upgrade period of time, no community would be left out. No community within the franchise area would be left behind. Now, that's at the 30 homes per mile or whatever agreed upon build requirements were, but it was, in essence, the ability of the cable operators to provide this service within our communities was done pursuant to the franchise agreement at consistent with the upgrade that had been negotiated under the terms of the franchise. And that is one reason why this service is broadly available. One of the things that I know I've been involved in discussions with Verizon and AT&T and Bell South about as we proceeded through this legislative session has been, what would a build-out requirement mean? What does that mean? And one of the pushbacks has been, we don't want to be forced to build anywhere outside of our footprint. We can't do that. That's just not economical. And we've all agreed. We don't necessarily think that it would be appropriate to force any telephone company to upgrade its existing service beyond where it currently provides service. We've also agreed with them that it's not something that anyone has ever done overnight or should be required to do overnight. It's not new build, it's an upgrade of existing services. So over the course of time, can they commit? It's one of those social requirements. Can they commit that over the course of time, where they already have infrastructure as they upgrade, that they would eventually upgrade everyone? You know, in some states, I think Virginia, it's outwards of 10 years, and then it's not 100% of every place and every citizen they serve, but it's a substantial proportion. So that seemed to be a reasonable approach within the state of Virginia, and I think that as states, they have the ability and should continue to have the ability to make those types of decisions. I think that just as Governor Engler indicated, Michigan made decisions,
Indiana's made decisions, Texas has made decisions. I don't always agree with their decisions, but I absolutely agree with the ability of a state to either make that decision for itself or to delegate that down to their local governments if that's what they choose to do. But I don't think that the federal government should be involved in dictating it.
I don't want to drag this out unnecessarily. I have a very sophisticated, eloquent argument. It's on a PowerPoint slide. It's not here, too. Real quickly, number one, I think Libby got it right in terms of the unfolding of the regulatory structure. So basically, there was a build-out requirement on video for some period of time that affected the rollout of cable modem service. As a factual matter, since 2002, when we roll out cable modem service, and now when we roll out digital phone, we roll it out everywhere. I mean, so there isn't really an issue about build-out because, in fact, our business plans suggest that we're going to go to every neighborhood where we can. I've said, I'm not, and I think Tom, to be fair, was setting up a bit of a straw man. Doesn't actually reflect what I've been saying in our policy. I've said many times, including at the House hearing, I think it is an odd thing for me to be arguing for my competitor to have a build-out requirement imposed on them. The question I ask everybody, since everybody seems to subscribe to the idea that a non-discrimination on the basis of income requirement, which is in existing law, should still apply in the future. The question I ask is, do you really mean it? I mean, you can make a coherent intellectual case for just to let the free market system work and eliminate that requirement, but everybody, including the telephone companies, say, no, we actually think that is a legitimate social policy that ought to apply to the provision of video services. My point is, if it's going to mean something, it has to apply to some particular jurisdictional area. It can't just be cherry-picked neighborhoods, otherwise it's an illusion. And people can disagree about where the gray area is. I think the obvious answer to why it might be a concern is that if you're holding one group of providers, call them cable companies, in a regulatory state with build-out requirements and you allow a new set to come in that have no such requirements, they're going to obviously go to those neighborhoods where they get higher ARPU, higher revenue per household, and they're going to go into those neighborhoods, and there's going to be an asymmetry in terms of competition. That is not a level playing field, which is why, despite Tom's knock on this, a level playing field doesn't have to mean level playing field up. It can mean level playing field down, but at a minimum, the idea that you're going to let the largest telecommunications giants in the world come in and just serve one community and hold the other guys down under a more regulatory regime, I just think is nuts. Now, fortunately, I think, at least in Congress, even if it's not exactly the model that we would be pushing for, I think at least there's a sense in both the House and the Senate that we ought to be treated the same. And the question is, okay, what are the rules that we should be treating these guys the same with?
Look, let me just quickly say I strongly disagree with Libby's interpretation of the law. Cable modem service is not regulated, and there's no build-out requirements there. They're not synonymous with regulation of the upgrades, by the way. But the battle was fought, and the best stuff to read on this is from the NCTA. They successfully fought including cable modem revenues in the franchise fee for video service. And they were successful in that. That is not included. That is not part of the cable operation. And that was fought several years ago. Cable One, I've cited it and so forth, and that's what the law is.
There is no disagreement. No, I mean, no. What you just said is right. I'm not sure what I said. Maybe I just said it poorly, but there's no disagreement.
I said they were not regulated, and you said you disagreed. If you agree with that, that's fine.
Okay, let's take our last, or at least one more question.
This proposal proposed sort of neutral
If I could take a quick shot at that. Principles of federalism should not be in conflict with our Commerce Clause principle of avoiding unreasonable restraints, unreasonable burdens on interstate commerce. And if you define the relevant market as the market for video service over a wire, you are defining the market in a much more narrower way than would the average consumer who just wants to know, where can I get video? Now, the average consumer, as I've said, can get video from two satellite providers, can increasingly get video over the internet from a multiplicity of wireless providers. If I sign up for Starz movies over my laptop, is that a local service? The difficulty we have here is, woe unto you if you decide that what you want to do is to upgrade your existing telephone company plant, invest millions of dollars to be able to offer consumers yet another choice. Then all of a sudden, it's going to be defined as something other than the market for video service. It's going to be defined as the market for a wireline-based video service. That's problem number one. Problem number two, this isn't just a big company issue. You know, I've got this guy, Lavoy Knowles, who's got a cooperative. I mean, his customers own his telephone company. And he's only got 40,000 customers in rural Tennessee. 40,000 customers happen to cross 25 separate franchise areas because it's rural Tennessee. And so what happens is that every franchise authority he goes to, there is a process by which the franchise he has to go through, and the franchise authority says, well, we'd like to see you build out to the rest of the franchise area. In one case, the franchise authority is a county. He's got three customers in that county. He can't build out to the rest of the county. The original telephone company service areas don't match the franchise areas for cable. And so what you've got is you've got this apples and oranges situation. And that's why we believe that there shouldn't be an unreasonable burden. This is an unreasonable burden, we think, on interstate commerce, because every service that's being delivered through that local principality, whether it's a wireline carrier or a laptop attached to a local cell tower, is an interstate service. If telephone service is interstate, anything delivered over the internet is inherently an interstate service. So that's where we come from.
Can I just add to that? I think, and partly I agree with this. I think, it's quite possible, in fact, it's probably a certainty, that several decades ago this would have been different. And fortunately, since law school, I haven't really had to think about the continuum that decides when something becomes interstate commerce. But
international shoe.
Right. See, I don't even remember that. I think the reality of what we do as a business, with video and with data and with phone, is almost all of it is going to be interstate by definition. I mean, even if you just look at the video service, you're talking about hundreds of networks that are coming in mostly on a satellite feed into a head-end and then into community. And we're whipping around on the internet backbone lots of video and to say nothing of the phone now and everything else. So to me, the interstate commerce element of this is pervasive. So our argument would be we do think we need, in terms of interstate commerce and flourishing competition, uniform national rules that guide us. Now, they should be judiciously applied and a light regulatory touch, as I've argued before. But it also doesn't completely answer the question about federalism, because just because you have a uniform federal framework does not answer the question of what sets of responsibilities still remain or assign to the local communities, the states, or the FCC in this case. And so you can still have a federalism answer within a uniform national framework. And I think that's where we come down, is I think, there, at least in terms of the cable industry, we are more comfortable that you can streamline a local franchising process and get to where Walter's guys and other competitors need to go without completely upending that process, just to satisfy the idea that you need to have all of the regulatory rules reside at the FCC, because I don't think we've actually thought through the consequences of that yet.
Let me interject and apologize. We've run out of time for more questions. But, Kyle, that's a perfect setup for our next panel, which will be addressing exactly the question of if we preempt, particularly on economic regulation, what are the appropriate functions that should not be preempted because they're better addressed at the state regulatory area. Let's take a 15-minute break, grab some lunch, and then Randy May, my good friend from the Progress and Freedom Foundation, is going to take over the hosting responsibilities for that second panel. Thank you, everybody, for coming today.
Thank you very much.